The Apollo Deep Geek, episode number 2, Apollo 8. Please be advised, there is a Santa Claus. Welcome to the Apollo 8 Deep Geek. I'm your host, James DeRuvo. The Apollo 8 Deep Geek is kind of a companion podcast for Conversations with Apollo. This is where we will break down each and every mission in celebration of the 40th anniversary of the Apollo program. With me this week, I have my guest hosts. We have Tim Callender. Say hello, Tim.
Hello, Tim.
And I also have Colin McKellar.
Good day. Come outside, yeah.
And Mike Din.
Hi, this is Mike Din in Canberra, Australia.
And Mike Smithwick.
And this is Mike Smithwick, not in Australia.
So we have an international lineup tonight as we break down and talk about the 40th anniversary of the epic Christmas voyage of Apollo 8. Just a little quick thing from Wikipedia. Apollo 8 was the first manned voyage to achieve a velocity sufficient to allow escape from the gravitational field of planet Earth, the first to enter the gravitational field of another celestial body, the first to escape from the gravitational field of another celestial body, and the first manned voyage to return to planet Earth from another celestial body, namely the Moon. The three-man crew of the mission commander was Frank Borman, Command Module Pilot James Lovell, and Lunar Module Pilot William Anders. All three became the first humans to see the far side of the Moon with their own eyes, as well as the first humans to see planet Earth from orbit from another celestial body. And picture takers of the most famous photograph in humankind, that of Earthrise. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Let's talk Apollo 8. So that Christmas Eve, as I remember barely, but I do remember as a boy watching that epic Apollo 8 broadcast on Christmas Eve on my grainy black and white television set. And now we have this high definition 1080p stereo LED mega whoopee TV sets with either satellite or cable. Mike Din, the broadcast that we get now from NASA TV, which by the way we'll be doing for the next for the 24th and 25th, we'll be doing an entire Apollo 8 program lineup wall to wall. Mike Din, how different is it now than it was 40 years ago?
Well, it has, as you say, moved on a long, long way. But after all, one would like to think that it's content that counts as much as the technology and send techniques. That television you would have seen would have been originating or coming to you through the Gulf Zone, California tracking station. Especially the Genesis reading, if that's what you're particularly getting at. We, however, in Australia, were also receiving that same television at the Unicycle Creek tracking station where I was running the operations. And, however, it did not leave the station. We did not have broadband links, microwave links out of the station at that time. So we were privileged to see it at the station, but it didn't get out of our particular orbit.
So,
I'm sorry. I wonder, you know, you're doing a job, okay? You've got a reason and a purpose for you to be at the tracking station. How hard was it to perform your duties while you're listening to this historic broadcast?
I always say it's a bit like acting in a play. Most of us, I suppose, at some point in our lives have spent a little bit of time, you know, in a school play or something like that. And when you're a player, you cannot, at the time anyway, appreciate the big thing. And you can't even necessarily see where your part fits into the big picture. Because, as you infer, when you're doing a job and you know a lot of things depend on you doing your job. You focus on that job, and you don't generally have the luxury of being able to look at the peripheral or even think about those things that aren't your responsibility. You're concentrating on doing your part, and you assume everybody else is concentrating on doing their part, which is, in my opinion, precisely how Apollo, or one of the main reasons Apollo was so successful. You didn't have a host of people marking everybody else's homework. The job was big enough and demanding enough to require everybody to do their own thing and not worry about others.
And I imagine you had some sort of simulations, pre-mission simulations, that you could essentially get all down to where once the real mission was happened, it was just repeating everything you'd done before.
Well, we did have simulations, but they weren't effectively sophisticated, and certainly not of a lunar mission. But in a few minor simulations, but there were so many things where we were writing the book, as it happened. I was lucky in that I had worked the previous 18 months at the unmanned station, Tidbinbilla, which was near our other manned flight station, and I worked on a surveyor program, which was the soft landing on the moon, and all the technology and techniques of communications, or at least the core of it, what was called the USB system, was designed and built by JPL, and that was what the Deep Space Network was using. So when I moved over to the manned space flight, I could read over a lot of that experience into the manned flight world. And so for Apollo 8, we were called upon for the first time to seriously use what was called the S-band system.
And since Apollo 8 was kind of a surprise, I never officially announced to the world until about a week or two after Apollo 11 splashed down. Did you learn about it?
Allow me to interject. You mean Apollo 7?
Correct.
Not Apollo 11.
Right.
Yeah.
You're quite right. We only learned about Apollo 8 being a lunar mission after the Apollo 7 flashdown. I know other people were working on it, and if you look at Colin McKellar's website and read Tom Sheehan's experiences of Apollo 8, you can see that he was beavering away on the planning for Apollo 8 during Apollo 7, but the rest of us did not know anything about it until after Apollo 7. So in a mere about, well, two months, no more than that, we went from Earth orbiting of a brand new spacecraft to a lunar mission, and at the time we were all 40 years younger, and it wasn't, in some ways, it wasn't a big deal, but looking back on it, it really is quite astounding, the courage and confidence that everybody involved seemed to have.
Yeah, according to what Tom Sheehan says here, he says that the gutsy decision to go lunar from Apollo 8 came at a time when lunar trajectory capabilities resided only in the offline mission planning and analysis division, computers and software. Many procedures for MCC's lunar mission operations were in an equal state of unreadiness. So they had a lot of work to do.
They had a lot of work to do, but they still had to get that done within only a few months after the initial Apollo 8 mission if they were going to go with the original flight schedule. So one wonders the kind of hours and the kind of work that they did have to do to accelerate that by a couple, really about 3 months of time, 4 months of time.
Yeah, according to Sheehan, he says, as Eddie Pickett said, we simmed Christmas 47 times before we actually had it.
and also about the simulation, the flight, the actual mission simulation, the technician, SimTech, weren't permitted, apparently, to tell their supervisor that they were running lunar orbit. Yeah.
And Tom mentioned there the problems they had with what we call the packing data, which was generated in a teletype manner using teletype data rates and miles of punched paper tape. And there was so much of it, it was backing up at Goddard. All the communications used to go through Goddard Space Flight Center. And the Goddard people said, well, we can get over that just by bypassing it, which they did for a while. But then Tomlin goes on to say that that was okay until the trajectory people find they were missing rather critical data. So they came up with some workaround to get the tracking data into Houston. I'm sure there must have been hundreds of thousands of stories like that of experiences that either you couldn't simulate, or if you had simulated them, you hadn't simulated them sufficiently well. Tom also talked, for example, about problems on Apollo 8 in the communication coverage between Aristotle and Madrid, that on certain declinations of the moon, we end up with only a few minutes of common view overlap. And Tom said that this surfaced as a problem that no one has really thought through ahead of time, and the Houston computers couldn't cope with what were called the horizon masking. They were all oriented to a 0-degree elevation type of communication angle. And then Tom's quite right that even today there can be problems between the Canberra longitude and the Madrid longitude.
Well, that brings up a question that I have. I'm gonna go off the reservation a little bit here as far as talking about Apollo 8. How different is the deep space network now than it was 40 years ago?
Well, its locations are identical. The very first antenna, the old 26-meter hour angle declination antenna, was retired 10 years ago, something like that. But the 64-meter antennas, which were expensive, say, to 70-meter, are in continuous daily use. They were built in the late 60s, and so they're used regularly. But there have been other antennas added over the years. But fundamentally, you can say there's no change other than enhancement, addition of capabilities, increased sophistication of computers, of course, an increased capability of operators. So the number of people to station are less. Oh, and I might say a very important thing compared with Apollo 8. We've had fiber optic communications into the tracking stations for a few years, but we ran the Apollo mission on two communication lines, each 2.4 kilobit, not for megabit, kilobit size. So you don't have to have all these megabits and gigabits of con.
And another processing was done in Stolson, wasn't it? Not all of the information was sent to Houston in real time. Only the information Houston needed.
Well, that's true. There were special telemetry decommutators, and for dependent on the mission phase, certain parameters would be sampled at lower rates, which more often than not was plenty. And so with some smart telemetry decommutation, you could bring the 56 kilobit signal, which is what we're generally receiving from the space up, down to fit on this 2.4 kilobit line.
Not to mention the fact that they saved a lot of the serious stuff for the tape dump, isn't that correct? Didn't they save a lot of that for the tape dump?
They certainly put Foreman's 24-hour illness on the tape dump.
That wasn't public knowledge.
Yeah, but stuff like didn't they save a lot of like reporting and detail work and a lot of that stuff? Didn't they save it for the tape dump? So that it didn't tie up bandwidth.
The onboard tape recorder, I don't know what the statistics are, but it was quite a relatively small storage capability. And I think it was designed primarily, and it was certainly used primarily, for maneuvers and behind the moon. And the first thing we used to do when they came out from behind the moon was dump the tape recorder. But its capacity was such that it really wouldn't have helped very much in terms of bandwidth, but obviously it helped a great deal on playing back data of things like the yellow lunar orbit insertion burn and the transit injection burn behind the moon.
The onboard data recorder, I think, would hold about an hour's worth of material, like 15 or 20 track.
What about that?
Now, were they able to were they able to erase that after once they delivered a report to Houston? Were they able to actually erase it and use it over, or did they not want to do that and they made it cumulative?
I have a feeling it was automatically erased. I don't honestly remember fooling for erasing reason, but maybe we did, but I can't remember now, I'm afraid. But certainly it was reused, that's for sure, and whether the erasing was automatic or at all commanded, I can't remember.
Okay, so you're on Apollo 8. Now, does Honeysuckle pick up right after launch, or when did the tracking stations come online right after the mission started?
Well, we didn't at Honeysuckle, but the whole of the network was up, and by the way, Cole has a very good piece of audio on that Honeysuckle website. Cole, why don't you speak to that around the world status check?
Really sure. It's a tape that was kept by Hamish Lindsay, who works at Honeysuckle Creek, and it covers a status check running right around the manned space flight network just a few minutes before the launch. So they go around maybe 15, 20 or so stations, and just checking the world online, and it's fascinating to hear those voices and each station checking in and giving a quick rundown on any equipment problems.
The tracking aircraft.
That's right.
You can tell which station you are available, and all the so-called downrange stations of Bahamas and Canary Islands, the section, they all track that first orbit, and it went over Carnarvon, this other important Australian station at Carnarvon, on the first orbit, but at the particular longitude, I don't think we tracked on Reg 1 on that particular mission, as I recollect. So
maybe I'm wrong.
So Apollo 8 launches on December 21st, 1968, coasted to the moon in 3 days and entered into orbit on Christmas Eve, 1968. Go ahead.
That would be about 4 or 5 hours from now, the 40th anniversary of the LLA.
Exactly. Were they orbited 10 times and over the course of 20 hours and gave a Christmas Eve television broadcast in which they read the first 10 verses from the book of Genesis. Colin, you tell me, you dropped me an email to say that you actually play the epic Apollo 8 reading of Genesis at your church, don't you?
That's right. You know, this year for the 40th anniversary, we'll be showing that video just a couple of hours before the actual anniversary in Australia. It was lunchtime on Christmas Day, and it was just an amazing thing to be sitting there at lunchtime waiting to have a Christmas lunch and watching that television. And, of course, nobody expected the astronauts would read from Genesis or do anything that was more profound than looking at the moon. But to be seeing the television and the craters on the mountains drifting past the command module window, to all them reading that, and then to hear Frank Borman saying, give his best wishes to everyone on the good earth, it just really struck a chord, I think, and so many people remember that.
And when you couple that with the epic, with the Earthrise photograph that ended up being on a stamp later the next year, that really drove the point home, I think. Tim, your thoughts?
What's interesting about that photo, I was just going back, rereading and scanning through the book Genesis by Howard Zimmerman, about the Apollo 8 mission. And Anders, who has a copy of that photo at his home, has it mounted basically so rather than being horizontal, in other words, having the moon, horizon, and Earth rising over it, it's vertical. Because, as Anders recounted, that was their orientation. They were basically orbiting at an equatorial aspect. And so it wasn't that the Earth, to his view, wasn't that the Earth was rising from the lunar surface. It was that the Earth was sliding from right to left from behind the moon's rim.
Playing peekaboo.
And it's just our own Earthbound perception that orients the image, the, you know, 90 degrees clockwise.
And there's also one of the photo editors at Manned Spacecraft Center who probably issued it to the media at the more common angle.
Right. That is an interesting observation, and I had often thought that, but someone chosen to present it in the landscape format. Again, Tom Sheehan comments on exactly what one means by the leading edge or trailing edge of the moon. He said they tried to get the pointing angle for the tracking station to point in the right side of the moon for when the first stuff came out. But he said one person was leading edge, whereas another person was trailing edge. And I can well understand that confusion. And just to add further confusion, in the southern hemisphere, of course, the moon's upside down. And that has led to some rather confusing
interpretations as well.
That's an interesting point. The southern hemisphere, where you and Colin are, the moon does appear upside down, doesn't it?
Now, we've flipped it right way around. You had a thumb on.
You got the thumbing on your head, you see, up there. But I remember standing out after Surveyor 1 landed. JPL, we acquired Active in Miller quite soon after Surveyor 1 had landed. And they said, well, look, all you have to do is and we were asking where it was physically on the moon's surface. And we did have a Borsight television camera attached to the antenna, which came up as a display in the operations room. And I said, well, you just go to the center and off at this, now for the right, and that's the location. But by the time he took into account the fact that we were in the southern hemisphere, that this camera was mounted on an hour angle declination mount, and therefore as you moved across an hour angle, the moon seemed to rotate in the camera. The fact that the top was the south, we gave up trying to work out where it was.
And what was the beam width of your main antenna?
Yeah, one interesting point. It was about a third of a degree, roughly, to the 3 dB point. And the moon is about half a degree. So this meant that for the 26-meter antenna, you had to point at the right part of the moon to get the best signal. You could still get a some sort of signal, even if you weren't optimally pointing. Also, you could end up with, although people were interested technically, you could end up with an interesting debate as to whether it is better from a signals of noise point of view to point at the moon or point off it a bit, because you do have the noise temperature of the moon influencing the signal and noise ratio. That will become a fairly exotic discussion, but can be quite significant if you're trying to get the best signal to noise ratio from space.
So this is a question. This is a question for the geek, since Mike was there. Since Mike Dinn was there, this is a question for the other geeks. We all remember sitting in front of that TV. Can we date ourselves enough to say we all remember that Christmas Eve?
Well, I don't, unfortunately.
Say again, Tim.
I don't, unfortunately. To be honest, my earliest recollections of the American space program come probably just after Apollo 10. I would have been trying to put it in there. Well, let's see. I would have been about 5.
That's like my vague memories of Gemini is the same way. But Mike, how about you? You remember that night?
Oh, definitely. Let's backtrack a little bit. Starting with Apollo 7, I took my dad's Polaroid camera and shot pictures off of the screen. But the lift off and splash down and things like that. So I had that set up for Apollo 8 as well, and migrated to 8mm movie film starting with Apollo 10. But I remember it extremely, extremely well. Apollo 8 was always my favorite mission, I think, because of just the inherent romantic notion of the grand adventure happening on Christmas Eve. And I got my first telescope that night, set it up, got from Edmund Scientific, and so I took it out. The first thing I aimed it at, of course, was the moon. as the crew was finishing up probably about orbit 8 or 9. And we had that night a gentleman from my parent church named Frank. I don't remember what his last name was, an elderly gentleman who was, I believe, it suffered a pretty bad stroke. So he had a tough time talking. He couldn't walk. He was in a wheelchair. And the very families would take him on the holidays. But he was otherwise quite alert. And I remember watching Frank there, watching the final broadcast on TV and wondering what was going through his mind. You know, unfortunately, he couldn't really tell us very well because he had a very tough time speaking. But it was just really a truly undeniably remarkable moment, and I think much more moving than any other time, including the first lunar landing, including Apollo 11, I can remember.
I've said, too, that there are those, even in among the astronaut corps, who consider Apollo 8 the greater mission compared to, say, Apollo 11. Those are the two standout highlight lunar missions from Apollo. There are those who think that Apollo 8 was the greater of the two.
Yeah. I mean, some people think that the race was over when we entered into lunar orbit. Yeah, you know, technically, Kennedy said, land a man on the moon. So that's what we did. But that's in a couple of more episodes. So
yeah, I think the point there, though, is that while, you know, obviously 11 was the culmination of all the effort, Apollo 8, in a very real sense, was the trailblazer. Those three men went where the man had gone before. But if Apollo 11 went back there, of course, Apollo 10 had to travel and actually come within, 10,000 feet of the lunar surface. You know, the hardware had been tested by the time Apollo 11 was
an aspect of Apollo 11, which I don't think gets enough play, and that is the survival in the space suit. I mean, the sophistication and challenges and solutions in the design of the suits and the design of the life support systems that went in those suits, and the ability to, you know, walk down a ladder and tromp around, I think because everything worked perfectly, as far as I can gather, on every mission, the achievements of that part of the mission, I don't think get as much of a guernsey, but say it off clearly, as they should. That, to me, was a tremendous achievement. And in fact, I guess I have a particular interest in that, when we were supporting Apollo 11, our priority was not the television signal. It was the reception and processing of the life support backpack telemetry and the biomedical information from the astronauts, which was far more important than the television. So that's a consideration if I throw in the ring.
Not to mention the fact that Jolly Wally thought the television was a pain in the rear.
Well, I understand also, if I recall correctly, Borman also wanted to veto the television on Apollo 8 as well. He was so adamant that this was a test flight and there were so many risks and unknowns and untested equipment that he wanted to minimize anything he possibly could, and including the food. I was, again, just reading in Genesis for Christmas Day, the company that had the food contract for the mission had packaged real turkey and gravy. And NASA wanted to go with that kind of foodstuffs for the whole mission, but Borman vetoed that because that was just one more new thing that they didn't need to test. You know, they've got the SPS system, which had never really been tried except for Apollo 7. But only that in minimal circumstances. You know, they were testing new navigational techniques. They were traveling farther and faster than anybody had before. So Borman's logic was, well, we know the dehydrated food we use at Gemini works, so let's stick with that. Let's not try anything new. And as I understood it, that he was overridden regarding the television.
And that is very much the test pilot engineer's outlook on life. You don't have much room for the PR or public relations side of things in your thinking. Somebody else has to think of that and give it the right priority. But those people are charged with a specific task, like landing on the moon and getting back safely. Television is not a necessity to that. However, it is and was a necessity from a PR and a political and an image point of view. So I think it's quite appropriate that those closest to it that could and did say it wasn't needed, but then it was equally appropriate for those who were concerned about the political ramifications.
Well, and I'd like to point out, and Colin, you can jump in here too, 40 years out, I think it's also equally crucial from a historical perspective.
I think the crew really got into the field of vision once they were on the way to the moon, and they were really quite enthusiastic about it. And the television pictures were remarkably good. They used the last of the RCA and a slow scan black and white camera. The Apollo 11 had the Westinghouse lunar camera, which is a similar format, but the television pictures were really quite amazing. And for me, they didn't have a viewfinder, so they couldn't see what they were pointing at. That was their main problem. When they were trying to show us what the Earth looked like, they had a lot of trouble getting the camera pointed in the right direction. But once they got that right, then the picture's really quite amazing.
And speaking of that footage, Colin, where can people see that footage?
Well, if you go to honeysuckleCreeks.net and follow the links to Apollo 8, there's a link there to Apollo 8 onboard footage. And there are some highlights from the sixth broadcast found not long ago on a videotape. The footage is widely available, but this is perhaps a slightly better recording that was made just after the mission. Oh, the guy at the Space Flight Center, and it's resurfaced, and so
I've been able to put that online.
And it's encoded in MPEG-4, so people who use Windows who want to watch it will need to use either QuickTime or VideoLand VLC Media Player in order to read it.
That's right. The Genesis reading is also available as a flash movie, and maybe I should need it for the rest as well. But it's nice to be able to see it.
And, it's not bad quality at all.
And as mentioned previously,
Colin, go ahead, Michael. And Colin has done a magnificent job in putting up the audio of the mission. And he says somewhere on the website that in many ways that audio is unique. It was recorded actually off what we used to call Net 1 at the tracking station, the air ground circuit, and therefore doesn't have the PAO, PR overlay on it. And so I don't think Colin or anybody else has come across a better audio recording than those. And Colin, in his inimitable manner, has put the, whatever it is, Colin, 80 hours or whatever it is, all audio, 3 hours worth.
Yeah. It was like reliving the mission. Yes, listening to it all.
Well, you know, I'm going to be downloading that and sticking it on my iPod for tomorrow, especially the Genesis mission, so that we can listen to it. That's
exactly listening to some of us today. And another thing about the audio is that being recorded at the television stations, quite a bit of it doesn't have the Quindo tones, which you normally hear on the public affairs recording, which could transmit us on and off. It was filtered out on a lot of the recordings so that this was what the astronauts heard that was sent up to them, rather than and just what was released by public affairs.
And there's one piece of audio which could have been there but isn't. That's where I actually spoke to Apollo 8 on the way out on the Translunar coast. We had some type of comm problem. I might say my colleague John Thetton insists it was me who pushed the wrong button. But anyway, we couldn't get through from Houston to the spacecraft, so I actually spoke up to them, and there's a little bit of an entry in the Lunar Journal on Apollo 8, trying to fill in those bits. I had for about 30 years a cassette recording of that, but I was feeling in a big tidy up of throwing out cassettes a few years ago. I got rid of it.
Oh!
But so it may still be in the account somewhere, but I don't think so.
Oh, that's a crime against humanity. I'm sorry.
And about how old were you at that time?
I was, what was it, 96, 37, 34. 34.
And it, yeah, you can see how young Mike Dinn looks if you go to my my website for Conversations with Apollo at apollotalks.com. Look up episode 2, Mike Dinn, Honeysuckle Creek, part 1. There's a nice little picture of a very young Mike Dinn.
Although, sir, did you tell me before it would clock to be old for the time?
But it I might all should be able to write an interesting book or chapter of a book in this regard. We were full of confidence, and I suppose if we hadn't been, I couldn't see that mission really having been full. There had to be confidence that is well in ourselves, and then confident in every other member of the team. Because everybody was so dependent on everybody else. And just in passing, I mean, you always see these Apollo movies where they show the mission comes the most there. And most people, I'm sure the people who listen to this sort of thing, are well aware that that was literally quite the tip of an iceberg. And even at Houston, there were hundreds of other people actively supporting the flight controllers. And then if you go down the tree into the worldwide networks and the RIAs and ships and all the contractors in the U.S., there were a lot of people taking an active part or at least being readily available if needed during the missions. And briefly, I think confidence played a great deal in the Apollos 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, which all occurred at two-up intervals.
Yeah, you know what I've always thought was interesting about the whole mission is you were saying you were so full of confidence. It was almost like you didn't know any better that you couldn't do it, so you just did it.
That's a fair comment. But also, I must throw in the ring the fact that we didn't have what I call the bean counter on the adminos and the politicians getting infused. In fact, all those people who were of that ilk in that era were actively working to help make things happen. Whereas I'm afraid as any organization matures, the administration and the budgeting and the funding and the financing and the headcounts all become more important than what the organization is there to do. So that was a factor as well. It was a young organization and it hadn't grown all the various pertinences of bureaucracy.
So, looking forward, and I'll take comments one at a time. Looking forward, since we're looking from 40 years hence now, and we all have listened to these recordings and read every conceivable book and watched From the Earth to the Moon and seen and just made basically a little hobby out of reliving those wonder years when we were children. Looking ahead, what will be the equivalent of Apollo 8's Christmas Eve journey? Will it be that first manned journey to Mars? What do you think? If we ever get there with things, I'm beginning to have my doubts now that this whole bailout thing is sucking out every possible dime. But what do you think? What do you think will be the next epic? Moment in the space program?
I think it's very tough to recreate Apollo 8 because there's so many different things that came together at the same time. The surprise of the mission, just the suddenness of the mission, again, the holidays, just the great number of firsts that had to be accomplished. If and when we finally get to Mars, I mean, we will build, we had already traveled beyond Earth with the following as a first sign, so that's not going to represent that first. And also there's a great immediacy with Apollo 8, since we were still within really immediate communications range when you get out to
a Mars or a Venus type mission, your communications is primarily just one way. And so you know that whenever anything happens, it happens 15, 20, 30 minutes ago. And so I think that's going to feel a little bit of the magic away from it.
I can't see there being any thought of a Mars mission until there's been a significant lunar program. There has to be a buildup of confidence in hardware and operations and software. I mean, I've no idea how you would check out a modern computer software-driven system to be ensured, to be confident that you've got a completely bulletproof system. So I would see the first missions, if and when Mars becomes another target, I think an Apollo 8 type mission, i.e. that is a trip out and an orbit and back, is probably the way it would start. I think it would and should take several years of experience of the Mars hardware in a lunar type, no further than a lunar type environment, before you could really seriously plan and train for a Mars mission.
Oh, definitely. And in talking about the mission that can, in a way, recreate the level of excitement interest that Apollo 8 had, the day before launch, the Apollo 8 crew had a surprise visit by Trevor Lindbergh, who came, and him and his wife had dinner with them. And that had happened only 41 years before then. So now we're looking back at about the same amount of time between now and Apollo 8 as Apollo 8 did going back to Lindbergh mission.
Yeah. I think what's going to be going to recapture that magic to a certain extent, if you're just looking about at recapturing that wonder, it's going to be when humans revisit Tranquility Base, because at that point it's going to be coming back to visit history. And I think that to stand there at a place where history has happened and look back on to reflect on it from the spot where that happened, I think that's going to carry some magic. But I agree with most everybody else here. I don't think a manned mission out to another planet is going to capture that for all those reasons. I think that moment rightfully has come and gone and been enshrined in history. It's at that point where we need to take those next steps. And if there's anything that's going to honor the achievements of Apollo 8 and all of the Apollo program, is to push it forward. And I think if we're just going to look for the next Apollo 8, we're going to be sorely disappointed.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's only one first time to leave the Earth, and Apollo 8 was really the first time to leave the Earth's orbit. Apollo 11 was the first landing, and after that, you've done that. And going to Mars will be wonderful, but it'll be very different, especially because of the delays in communication. It won't be immediate. It'd be like reading
yesterday's newspaper.
Now imagine sending a mission back to the moon just to go to Tranquility Base and seeing it in full 1080p high definition orbit.
Oh, yeah. Although, isn't there some sort of law now that prohibit anyone from actually going to Tranquility Base, preserve it as a monument?
I don't know, because I understand there's an XPRIZE project going on that's looking for private individuals, private groups to land a robot at Tranquility.
They have a big XPRIZE. The call was to go close enough to take pictures, but not to disturb the site, hopefully.
Quite frankly, I think it's worth $20 billion to go back to the moon just to shut up the people who said we never went in the first place.
And go to that limit.
With something like a Google X Prize, it'd be nice if they could go back and set the flag back up that fell down on the liftoff.
I just see this little robot arm coming, picking it up and beep, sticking it back in there, and then it falls over again and it's got to pick it back up.
Now, getting back to Apollo 8, one of the interesting things about that mission, and looking back when I was like 10 years old or so, 12 years old when it happened,
space travel was by definition the most exciting thing that could ever happen to someone. But yet, most of the experiments and test objectives took place when they were in lunar orbit or heading close to the moon. And so they had a lot of time to sit and twiddle thumb. And there's talks about it actually being fairly boring on the way out, even though then he was a rookie and was terribly excited to fly. There are times when the tedium just got pretty grand there, mixed with the Frank Borman illnesses that certainly did not could give a pleasant aroma in space craft from Levy. That took a little bit of the romance away from the actual crew that went out there.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of From the Earth to the Moon, where the actor that's playing Chris Kraft, they're talking about Frank Borman's illness and how he's up chucking. He goes, man, it's got to spell bad up there.
And apparently the skin divers on the recovery team, when they popped up in the hatch, they smelled it. Like six days in a floating outhouse.
Well, the other comment that I recall reading is three of them were surprised to find that they all had the same impression that it was so much like the simulation that it was almost like not flying the mission. You know, it was so but like what they had been training for months and months and months that there was no surprise.
Except for the launch. I think the first and second stages of the launch, they had never simulated correctly.
How can you simulate that kick in the pants to William Anders, who's never been up?
Yeah, exactly. It was considerably more violent than they expected to be.
Say again, Mike. Or Colin? Okay, I'm sorry. We're going to have to ask you to repeat that.
Sorry. Yeah, Frank Borman reported about having some pogo effect, which plagued the previous unmanned 2005 launch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Although I understand it was not nearly as violent or as rough a ride as it was on the Gemini Titan craft.
Both the Gemini and the Atlas, I think, had considerably stronger acceleration during launch.
Well, you remember reading in Lovell's book, Lost Moon, he talks about the liftoff, and the thing was with the Titan, it was programmed to look for the horizon and make adjustments on acceleration and heading toward orbit accordingly, so it would swing, pitch and yaw constantly, and apparently the Saturn V was not nearly as wild a gyration.
Although it did have the pogo, fortunately they figured out the pogo stuff, but
that's different from pitching,
swinging back and forth. Yeah, how do you beat Fred Hayes? I bring Fred Hayes into the conversation because here's the guy. He's the backup lunar module pilot for Apollo 8. He gets bumped off Apollo 8 for Apollo 11 because of an accident, and goods on Apollo 13 never ever gets to the moon. Not once, but twice. And what does he get rewarded with? Oh, I get to do the approach to landing test on the shuttle.
Yeah. James, that's interesting that you bring that up, because this is something that I've been reflecting on, rereading all the books and material and stuff. And having been a child, man, and you'd love to go to space, okay? And you think about, especially as a kid, you look at the, like, Borman, okay? He was commander on Gemini 6, 7, excuse me, at Apollo 8. That's only two space flights. And then he's done. Now, as a kid, you're not aware of all the months and years that they put into training. And as we commented on the Apollo 7 deep geek, that, that time was really compressed as well because it was late nights and weekends, okay? So he only flies twice. Anders only flew once. And I recall thinking as a kid and reading about this, it's like, how could you only ever fly into space once? But then you look at it, say, with Anders, he comments that
you looked at where the program was heading and you knew that it was going to be scaled back at some point. And what was the likelihood that he'd fly again? Well, maybe as a command module pilot, so he was not going to land on the moon. So what's the point? Borman felt, you know, he announced his retirement a few weeks before Apollo 8 because he felt that this, for him, was the ultimate flight. You know, Jim Lovell is the kid's astronaut because he flew in space four times.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know,
I'm very jealous of Jim Lovell.
Right, exactly. You know, Neil Armstrong, same kind of deal. He flew twice, and one of those was Gemini 8, so that wasn't even a full day in space where they had to come home.
Yeah, but there was no way in God's green earth Neil Armstrong was going to return to the moon.
Well, but what exactly? But, you know, that part of that is the nature of the program, but the other part of it is, you know, again, when you're a kid, you don't think this way, but, you know, it's like, what is there to do after that? You're the first man ever to step on another planet.
Well, you know,
go to Disneyland.
You know, interesting that you mentioned that. I had a friend of mine who works at the Disneyland Hotel, and he told me about the time that Neil Armstrong checked into the Disneyland Hotel and he wouldn't sign the register. And they asked him why, and he says, well, obviously, because I don't want it to end up on eBay. And, you know, and it's a very telling point that he has had, even to be the first man on the moon. And you got to give the man credit that he has really kept to himself and just let that moment speak for itself up until the point when he contributed in writing the book First Man. But for a long time, he was just content with going back home to Ohio and teaching at Purdue University and just letting the first man on the moon be the first man on the moon.
And you got to have all the of integrity there too, and you got to respect him for that, even if we wished he'd do a little bit more sometimes.
And then you add Buzz Aldrin, who made it clear being the second guy on the moon.
Yeah, and that well, we should probably say that for our Apollo 11 geek.
Yeah,
it's you know, there's a certain irony in that as well. Well, you know, to bring it back to Apollo 8, again, you look at the careers that those three astronauts had after it was all said and done. Anders went on to become a deputy at NASA and went into public service for a little bit. Borman went on to be CEO of Eastern Airline. Bubble, of course, continued on with the program for a while, but eventually retired and went into private industry.
Wrote a little book that became a little movie, and now he has a restaurant.
Right.
Mike Dinn, a thought?
Well, I've been listening to that with interest. My first 5 years of my career here in Australia was in aircraft flight testing, and I got to know quite a number of test pilots very well during that period. And they are a unique bunch of people. They can be absolutely not fully and completely focused on the task at hand, and any emotions, passions, or luxuries of thinking about the bigger picture, they can completely switch that off. It's not that they can't do it, but they could be number one in their job and their profession. They really have to focus on the job at hand. And the ones I've come across all seem to have that attribute. And in fact, I don't quite know how they can then switch on and become more expensive in their views and write books. But it's almost a contradiction to their
way of life.
Okay, you know, what's so interesting about the reading of Genesis, even at that point, they're in the midst of the mission, and given Borman, whose personality was utterly focused on the mission, you know, like you said, Mike, it's like, what a time to flip that switch, because that reading was not planned except by the astronauts. Nobody knew what they were going to say. It was a complete surprise that they were ever going to read it. And, you know, I mean, that's one of the things, because I've been doing a great deal of reflection on that little part of it. And while I'm not Christian, that is not the faith and philosophy that I follow,
I find it extremely moving because it's so human. And that's, you know, as much as anything, and, you know, maybe this is the goofy romance, but that's what robotic exploration is, as neat as it is, as cool as all the rovers and the orbiters around Mars are returning cool data, and Phoebe and Galileo when it was at Jupiter. And I know we're going to see neat things from New Horizon when it heads out toward Pluto and beyond. To hear the reaction, those three men looking down at another world that is so unlike the world of their origin. How can you not be? And knowing that it at point isn't strictly about any one particular fate. It was it's what gave meaning to those men's lives, and by extension, you know, it gives meaning to all our what to try to find our place in the universe. And that, to me, is just so moving. And that's, you know, as we talked earlier, there may not be another Apollo 8, but it will be so different, even if it's 20 minutes later, to hear the first words, the first name, to set foot up to Gary Plano.
And we got to wrap this up, but I want to finish. I kind of want to use what Tim just said to bookend with something that Frank Borman said, that when he met with the Pope, when they had an audience with the Pope, Pope Paul VI told Frank Borman, "I have spent my entire life trying to say to the world what you did on Christmas Eve."
Wow.
Oh, yeah, very happy.
And on and Andrew, when he returned, he said, "We went to the moon to discover the moon, but instead we discovered the earth."
I want to thank my guests. Mike Dinn, former executive director of the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station from Australia. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been fascinating.
Colin McKellar, his neighbor across the way, who runs the Honeysuckle Creek website at honeysucklecreek.net, where you can see all the Apollo 8 videos. Colin, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, it's been a pleasure.
And we have Mike Smithwick of Distant Suns. Is that distantsuns.com, Mike?
Yeah, it is.
Distantsuns.com, where you can get a really cool computer program to help you gaze at the stars and on the moon. And, of course, now on the iPhone. And, of course, Tim Callender, who's living on the East Coast, burning the midnight oil. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a lot of fun, especially talking with Mike and
Colin halfway around the world. Oh, yeah.
And to all of our friends who are listening, we hope you have a happy holiday and a happy new year as we move on. Our next episode of The Deep Geek will be Apollo 9. Thanks for joining. You've been listening to the Apollo Deep Geek, of the companion podcast to Conversations with Apollo. For more information, visit our website at www.apollotalks.com. Got a question or comment? Drop us a line at apollotalks@gmail.com, or you can leave us feedback on the iTunes website. Theme music is from Brain Bucket, courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network. The song is Rocket Science. Visit them on the web at www.brain-bucket.com. The Apollo Deep Geek is a copyrighted podcast under the Creative Commons license from Quinn Dollar Entertainer. Copyright 2009.